The following program is an MLWRadio.com production.
You remembered them fondly, and then they were gone. And now you want to know who, what, where, when, why.
We having fun, yeah.
Why It Ended with Robbie E. and Matt Coon.
And here we are again on our second episode of Why It Ended with Robbie E. Robbie, how you doing today?
I'm doing awesome. And let me just say, I'm a confident guy inside and outside the ring. I've always been in life. In fact, even some people think I'm an asshole sometimes, and that's fine. But even I did not think that we were going to be received with this podcast the way we've been received. The numbers we've been getting, dude, we were ranked 15 at one point in all of sports podcasts, bro.
I'm not sure how that happened. At one point this week, we were the second highest rated wrestling podcast. And it was only our first episode. And we only have one person to thank, you people out there. Thank you for listening. Thank you for telling people about us. And we are so happy with you that we are going to bring you what I think is going to be one of the greatest interviews in wrestling podcast history. How excited are you to hear about Muhammad Hassan, Robbie?
I'm pumped. I think this story, I mean, like, Glacier was great. It's going to be hard to beat, but I actually think this possibly can in a different way. It's a different kind of story, but it's certainly going to leave our jaws dropped, kind of like last week. Our jaws were dropped just to how amazing the interview was. And, you know, I've been doing press all week for, you know, this podcast, promoting it. I've been doing other podcasts talking about this podcast. And I just wanted to say, Matt, I came across someone who was talking about you and how I said how great you are at editing and everything. And they actually said that your voice sounds like chocolate sex, or what was it that they said about your voice?
I believe that Nick Houseman from WrestleZone said that my voice was the best voice ever, and it was smooth, silky, and chocolatey.
Okay, so I don't know how I got chocolate sex from that, but I knew there was chocolate in there. And that just, it left me baffled. It kind of creeped me out. And I think this guy's got a crush on you. So what I want to know, Why It Ended listeners out there, please tweet us at Why It Ended. Do you think Matt's voice is silky and chocolatey? Is that weird or what?
Oh, yeah.
Ew. I don't even want to do this interview with you.
Well, you're going to have to, because we got him on the line. Once again, we are Why It Ended. You can get us on iTunes. Make sure to subscribe. Leave us one of those 5-star reviews. And also, if you're not an iTunes user, you can always stream us from whyitended.com. We got a lot of cool stuff coming up, a lot of t-shirt ideas. And also, we're going to have a YouTube channel starting soon. Things have gotten crazy, Robbie, and it's about to get even crazier. Coming up right after this on Why It Ended, Muhammad Hassan. All right, Robbie, without any further ado, we are joined by the subject of one of the most fascinating chapters in wrestling history, Mark Capone, known to the wrestling world as one of the most effective characters in the history of sports entertainment, and my dream guest for the show since its conception, Muhammad Hassan himself, Mark Capone. Thank you for joining us today, Mark.
No, you're very welcome, Matt.
Hey, man, yeah, I just wanted to say also thanks for being on this show, because you are the perfect person for the show. And we want to get right into it for our fans, bro. So, like, when did you dream of first becoming a pro wrestler?
Probably when I was, I don't know, 9 or 10. I remember my brother, who's a couple years older than me, cousins who were around my age. We used to put on wrestling shows in the basement, which were probably horrible. But we used to, you know, tell my parents every Friday would have my Uncle Benny, my Aunt Jackie, who had a couple kids, and my cousin Al and Barb. And they had a couple kids who were a little younger than us. But
you your own characters, or were you wrestlers from TV?
I think we were our own characters. I can't go that far back, but I don't think we were as evolved enough to play character. We just liked to get in. We just liked to wrestle and, you know, mess around down there and then put on a show. So we would invite them down and we would have our shows in the basement and probably beat the crap out of each other for no reason. But it wasn't until I was in college where I started hanging out with some guys who watched wrestling, and I kind of lost it. I played sports and kind of fell off the wrestling wagon for a while. But when I started watching in college, I remember thinking this was something I really admired, and I started to really appreciate the show and the athleticism. And I was at the time very into working out. And so I started watching it every, you know, every chance I could get, all the pay-per-views and Raw, and then eventually SmackDown. And so it was in college where I decided that this was something I wanted to try and something that I thought I could do. And that's when I moved to Louisville. I was about 21 years old when I left college and moved down there. So
what year was that?
2001.
So I started in 2000. So you started in 2001. So same kind of time frame. So I know where your head was at. Mine was in the same place. So did you finish college or did you completely drop it to go start wrestling?
I dropped it. And then I went to University of Louisville because I went to OVW for a semester and my heart just wasn't in it. You know, fast forward to the future. And I went back to SUNY Oswego in New York and got my undergrad and then my master's and then my CAS. So I've actually been through 8 years of college and in higher education. So
wow, that's awesome.
I'd hate to say I dropped out because I'm a principal now. So I got to add in that I also went back and kind of put a lot of time into it. I got a 4.0 all throughout those years. So I definitely rededicated myself to education.
You moved to Louisville in 2001. You joined OVW in 2002, and you debuted as Mark Magnus later that year. Do you remember who was it that put us in contact with you?
It was Nick Aldis, who was the new Magnus.
Go figure.
Who I admire. I love Nick. So Nick asked me the other day, and all he had to do was ask.
Awesome. When you did go to OVW, you went there on your own completely. There was no contract or anything. It was just you going there to try and make a dream happen.
Yeah, no, I started off in their Saturday class, which I had to pay to do. And then we would, you know, do all the shows, break down the rings, well, set up, break down the rings, sweep the floors at the TV events. Yeah, we definitely started from the bottom. Myself, Johnny Jeter, and Chris Cage, or Chris Pavone, were the first three non-contract guys invited to their everyday class, which was the class that had the John Cena's and the Randy Orton's and the Batistas. We were basically their dummies. They're tackling.
Yeah.
They beat the crap out of us. But we were the first three to really break that mold.
But when that happened, did you feel like you might actually have a chance of making it? Like, did you still kind of feel like there's no way that this could actually happen?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I remember Nick Dinsmore was one of my trainers, and Danny Davis and Jim Cornette were down there. And I think it was Nick and Danny, they took us into a room back at the old arena before they moved out into that big facility they have these days. This was when they were in Jeffersonville. And they told us, I think it was like a Tuesday night, we were there working out with John Cena and Batista, Matt Morgan. And they said, pretty much, you guys don't have a chance. You're not big enough. The WWE is not looking to sign guys like you. They're looking to sign monsters. They're looking to sign professional athletes, you know, but hang with it. We're going to set you up with some local shows, you know, blow smoke up our butts at all. They were pretty straight with us and told us we really didn't have a chance, but we persevered and we stuck with it. And all three of us eventually made it to the WWE.
You know, I remember when I first started out, when there's no money involved and you just have the dream, that's when it's the most fun.
Oh yeah. You know, staying in Super 8 motels that I'm pretty sure some shady drug deals and murders had been.
Oh, you know, for sure.
We were very hesitant to sleep on the beds. Yeah, no, but it turned out to be, it really was some of the greatest memories that I have and some of the greatest times in my wrestling career.
Well, it sounds like you had the dream, but maybe not the expectation, because you had so many blue chippers in there with you. You were there at the height, Brock Lesnar, and you had Batista, and you had Cena, and you had Shelton Benjamin and Randy Orton. And you mentioned Jim Cornette. And at some point, Jim Cornette comes to you and tells you or suggests to you that WWE wanted, quote, an Arab American character. Is that how you remember it?
I want to say it was Arn Anderson who was down in OVW, you know, scouting other talent. And the agents would come down every week or every couple of weeks just to see what they had in developmental. And they floated the idea of an Arab character by myself. And that was when Daivari had came in. At the time, I was Mark Magnus. I wasn't part of the Revolution. I was just starting to, you know, become noticed on TV. I was still working at Chili's, you know, full time. I was not a contract guy. Yeah. So Jimmy approached me with it. And at the time, it was a much different character than what it turned out to be. But yeah, they said, how would you feel about doing it? And you don't ask questions. You say, yes, sir, I'll do whatever you need me to do. That was some training from Rip Rogers, who was another trainer down there. Just be prepared for anything and say, yes, sir, whatever you need me to do.
Bro, I always say, if you know, when they're like, oh, would you do this for that? And I'm like, dude, if the situation's right, I would be a ballerina, no problem. You know what I mean? It's pro wrestling. You know, who cares? Of course you say yes.
Oh, yeah. Everybody wants their shot. So I was more than happy to take the gig.
Hey, Mark, have you ever seen Robbie E. Russell? He's not that far from a ballerina, so it's not, not that big a stretch. Hey, so they tell you that you're going to be an Arab American character, and you agree. What was that process like? What were you told at first? How was the idea presented to you?
I had won the OVW heavyweight title from Johnny Jeter, who was my best friend, and it was one of my favorite matches. And they said that now you're going away for a while. And that was the worst part about the whole experience is my character on OVW, because Jim Cornette is all about kayfabe, and he takes it very, as you guys, I'm sure know, Jimmy is a mastermind. So my character had to leave TV, after I lost the title to Nick Dinsmore and Johnny Jeter in a three-way match. I think I lost it to Jeter, and I went away for, I think, 4 months. And that was one of the more difficult times in OVW, because I couldn't go to TV. They didn't want me anywhere. I could go to practice, but I couldn't be part of their TV shows. I couldn't do their house shows. I came back as having left because I was so distraught, and I lost Nikita LaFleur, who was my valet at the time. And I came back as this angry Arab character, kind of re-embracing my heritage. Ironically, I'm 100% Italian. That was the process. And then the character kind of started pretty slow on OVW. It really wasn't long before I was doing house shows. And I remember we were toying with the idea at house shows. And so Pat Patterson would write, you know, just a little promo that I would do in the ring. And at first it was like, I'm stealing your oil. At first I was very Arab. It wasn't until a little bit later, and I'm not even kidding, like stealing your Arab.
You.
Yeah,
I believe you.
It wasn't until later that I became Arab American. And that was genius. And Davari and I kind of took that gimmick and we ran with it. Sean is another person who I would say is a mastermind of wrestling psychology in and out of the ring. And we took that gimmick and we ran with it and we turned it into something that I think is very relevant still today, which is a third class citizen, someone who is a citizen of this country who feels like they are downtrodden and treated with disrespect and marginalized. And so the character really, it didn't start out as from Detroit in American. It kind of really evolved from OVW through the WWE house shows until what eventually became my debut against Mick Foley.
For you, you're on national television, TV worldwide doing this character. Like, as you were going into this, like, how hard was it for you to become that? And then, like, what did your family think, bro? Because this is like a big change in your life. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You know, at first it was a little difficult to really get into the character, but to be honest, once I started wearing the traditional Arab head garment out in public and on planes, and I remember a situation, I believe we were flying out of San Francisco, where Sean and I were wearing it. And, you know, keep in mind, 9/11 was still fresh in people's minds. It wasn't that far off. It was 4 or 5 years later. And the boys were coming up and we were sitting towards the front of the plane. They're like, hey, people are calling their families right now. And they were nervous. And I remember, you know, similar, we were someplace, I think it was in California, where we were walking to the hotel from the parking garage and a family was approaching us. Keep in mind, I mean, I'm from Syracuse, New York. I mean, Italian American, my family came here, you know, 70 years ago. You know, after World War II, we were very assimilated, and these people stepped off the sidewalk to walk around us, you know, and you could see the fear in their eyes and in this little girl's eyes. I remember, I'll never forget her looking at us and my anger. And not to mention that Davari got random, and I'm doing random in air quotes, randomly searched at every airport. My anger kind of grew.
By pretending to live it, you actually felt what it's like to be one of them. So you kind of got it, right?
Absolutely.
Were you told you had to wear those headpieces 24/7, like when you were traveling and stuff?
We weren't told. It was suggested, and we said, yeah, absolutely. That's a good idea. It wasn't very difficult to get into that character when you were living that character 4 or 5 days a week.
When that happened, you must have looked at each other and said, I think we got something here. I think this could work.
Definitely.
Oh yeah, we knew, everybody knew we had something. I mean, there hadn't been a character, a foreign character like this since, you know, the Iron Sheik, or since Sergeant Slaughter turned, you know, 20 years before us, you know, 35 years ago now. But we knew we had something, and like I said, it definitely fueled our in the ring performance, especially the promos, because those came from the heart. They really weren't written for us. We were told what we wanted to hit if we had a match coming up, or obviously the character or who we were wrestling. But, you know, a lot of that was impromptu, and it was something that we felt, and we knew that we were speaking the truth in a divided country at the time. That was 15 years ago.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the initial vignettes. I think that's what a lot of people remember. I know I remember it. It was these vignettes as you and Daviri were talking about your frustration as being Arab Americans in the wake of discrimination after 9/11. And according to Wade Keller of the Pro Wrestling Torch, forum sources insisted that Vince McMahon originally booked you guys with an open mind as to whether you'd be portrayed as heels or babyfaces. You just pled your case in the vignettes, and when the Raw crowds booed the vignettes, and when you guys were booed at house shows, they decided to make you guys heels. Is that true, or is that kind of wishful thinking?
I think it's a little more wishful thinking. It might be true. I mean, how do I know what was going on in Vincent's head? I'll tell you that we always knew we were going to be heels. I don't think anybody. I mean, I was prepared prior to those vignettes. I remember Arn Anderson was someone who I had spoken to a handful of times. Be ready. And Jimmy Cornette, because, you know, Jimmy takes care of his, he took care of his OVW guys like they were his children. And Danny Davis did as well. Be prepared for the hate mail. And they told me the stories of Sheik and Slaughter and, you know, the way they were treated. So it's possible that they could have turned us babyface, but I don't think that most people expected them to cheer us. I think everybody knew they were going to boo us. I think everybody knew the demographic we were, you know, performing to, and had an idea that they were going to hate us, not even because we were Arab, but because we were shining a light on the hypocrisy and some of the things they believed in. And we were hitting pretty close to home with how they were treating Arab Americans at the time, and they still do today. So maybe that's true, but I think that they knew we were going to be heels regardless.
Part of the genius of your initial push, which was you guys were incensed at the double standard. It seems like plausible deniability to introduce an Arab character that people can boo, and it goes hand in hand with the plausible deniability of them setting you guys up to say, okay, we're setting them up as neutral and the fans can boo them. It seems to me that a buffer was put in place to make it okay to boo you guys for being Arab Americans.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the tone of those vignettes, though, from start to finish, they became more aggressive as we got to the end. And I've seen some pretty good cuts of those. And you could see, you know, and that was how we were directed. So, yeah, of course, it would be plausible deniability to say that we didn't know if they were going to be baby faces or heels. But the tone of it definitely changed as we went from the first vignette as we got to the last vignette. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there was any question or whether or not people were going to boo. I mean, they were booing from the beginning. And by the time we got to that fourth or fifth one, you know, it was pretty clear and obvious that we were heels.
When you guys first got called up to the main roster, like doing the house shows and stuff, when it was pretty much known that you guys were probably going to get a monster push based on the character and everything, was there any like jealousy or anything in the locker room, or guys giving you a hard time about, like, you know, the spot you were getting?
Yeah. I mean, initially, and that lasted for a few months. I don't know if it was necessarily because we were getting a big push. Maybe. I mean, I'm sure that had something to do with it. I know that when I was up there, which was, you know, a relatively short amount of time, any new guy coming into that locker room got heat. You know, I could think of, you know, some of the nicer guys that I trained with in OVW who came up there, and they got heat. Maybe not as much as I did. I'm sure that had a lot to do with the push that we were getting and the fact that we were so new and we were so young. I mean, Sean was like 20 years old, 21 years old. I was 24, 25. Wow. But there was definitely heat in the locker room, and that heat is usually associated with anybody new coming into the spotlight. But we definitely got a lot of it. I got a lot of it. Sean was much smarter than I was. He had been in the business a lot longer than I had been, even though he was younger. So, and he wasn't as much of a threat. Sean was a manager, even though he was a talented wrestler. He really wasn't utilized as a performer, so as a in-the-ring performer. So there was heat. There was heat. Well, I mean, everybody knows that.
Well, we're definitely going to talk about Sean, and we're definitely going to talk about heat. When you guys first appeared, WWE kind of wanted to create that plausible deniability so much that they actually released a statement that said WWE is introducing two new Arab American characters on Monday Night Raw. Raw will explore the challenges Hassan and Daivari face as Hassan tries to make his mark as a new WWE superstar. Is this kind of doublespeak kind of indicative of what was to come throughout your run and towards the end?
Yeah, but I don't think that was the original intention. I think that's just a nice little tagline to put on the characters, because I remember the character, Muhammad Hassan himself, was never really trying to be a heel. And, you know, most heels, most bad guys, whether it be in wrestling or in movies, any villain always thinks that they're right. They always have their own perspective. From Hassan's perspective, he always felt that he was right, even when he was interrupting people and interrupting good times and, the top baby faces. He always felt that he was doing it for a good reason and had a good message. So I don't know if that was as much a double talk or just kind of a nice little tagline to put on the character to keep him neutral and allow the fans to hate that character on their own and come to it on their own without being told they're supposed to hate him.
So you have a dark match at Taboo Tuesday against Sergeant Slaughter, and then you make your Raw debut in an in-ring thing with Foley. Like, how did you feel like working with like legends right away, like so quick? Did you feel like, all right, they have so much confidence in us, this is going to be huge?
No, I didn't think like that at all. I think it was definitely an honor working with Slaughter, working with Mick Foley. They were both great. At the time, you're very much enveloped in the moment. You're not really thinking it's with that kind of perspective and that kind of frame. We were just trying to get by, and we were just trying to make our mark and secure a spot, because it's a very competitive roster at the time. So we were very aware that we were working with these incredible talents. I mean, it was definitely a milestone in my career to work with Sergeant Slaughter. That was something I definitely called home and told my father and my brother about. But I don't think it really dawned on us, at least not on me. There was so much going on that it was just day to day, live in the moment, do what you're asked to do, and do it as best as you can do it.
Speaking of Sergeant Slaughter, of course, he had his greatest feud against the Iron Sheik, and you had Sean Daivari, and they both shared the same first name. I believe that was probably in tribute to the Iron Sheik. How important was Daivari to you, not just on screen, but off screen, where he wrote a blog that people reacted to that seemed to feed into your on-screen characters? How important was he to the overall act?
Oh, he was vital to the overall act. There would not have been an act without Daivari. Not just because he could speak Farsi, which isn't even Arabic. It's indicative of Iran, which is where his family's from. But Sean was instrumental in not only pushing the character, but developing the character. Sean was the one that was going through this. I mean, at the time we were traveling with like Gene Sininski, Chris Masters, and we used to kind of laugh because Sean really did get flagged for every random search. And so Sean's perspective was instrumental in developing the Hassan character, not to mention, out of the ring and off screen. Sean really took care of me. Sean was, like I said, much smarter, much wiser about the business. My thing is, I would speak when I shouldn't have spoke, and I would be quiet when I needed to speak. And Sean was always in my ear telling me what I needed to do. He definitely was an asset, not just to me, but to the company at the time. And he still is one of my better friends because of it. I mean, we don't talk as often as we should because he lives in Minnesota. He's running the Academy of Professional Wrestling out there, which is doing fantastic. But Sean was Hassan and Daivari. It would not have existed without Sean.
Right. You work with kids, as do I. You talked about heat earlier, and you have to deal with bullying and a lot of complaints about bullying. And at the time you were there, I think a lot of people feel that bullying was maybe an all-time high, maybe hazing. And one story is about how Kurt Angle mentioned to you about how Eddie Guerrero was using your finish as a transition move. Maybe you should say something. You did. People freaked out. They had a wrestling court, and you had to pay over a $2,000 bar bill as your punishment. Do you think you were dealt with fairly in comparison to the other wrestlers in the back?
I don't know. That's a relative term, is fair. What is fair? I remember that incident. I remember, everything about it. It was in Japan. It was definitely a lower moment in my career, but looking back on it, it was definitely a character builder. I mean, obviously, I would never disrespect Eddie Guerrero. Eddie Guerrero was one of the guys I looked up to, because Eddie and Chris Benoit at the time were two guys small in stature that were at the top of the card, and because of their talent and because of their ability. And I don't think Kurt meant anything by it also. I think Kurt was also a top guy who was at the time inexperienced in the professional wrestling, you know, universe, who was just looking out for, you know, top card guys. And I don't think that Kurt meant any harm, and Eddie definitely did not take it the way that everybody else did. I think that was just kind of a torch that everybody else could grab and say, look, this kid is an awful human being. And I don't know if everybody felt that way at the time. I had plenty of guys who had my back. And the $2,000 bar tab, I mean, that's a great story, but it is what it is. And I'm sure I'm not the only person who's paid a bar tab at the expense of the other WWE guys. But like I said, it's a relative term. Was I treated fairly? Would it be different these days? You know, according to a lot of people, it would have been. But at the time, that's what I had to deal with. And I would never play the victim and say I was bullied. I had a lot of control over the situation, and there are plenty of things that I could change and could have do differently looking back on it. But hindsight's 20/20. Those are the cards I was dealt, and I dealt with it at the time. And that passed too. I mean, that wasn't the end of my career. That was, you know, it was months and months later where the Hassan character was eventually taken off of television. So, and at that time, I was getting along with everybody just fine. So those were part of the growing pains of being in the WWE, being a top guy, being 24 years old, and being very new to the business.
Isn't it insane that things like this could just get online somehow? Things that happen, you know, not on television, that the whole world could just know about when you think about it. Isn't it freaking crazy?
It is, but not really. I mean, I work in a high school, so I could really, you know, compare working in the WWE to working in a high school where a rumor starts and by the time it gets to somebody, it is 10 times bigger and 10 times different than what it originally had happened. And that's exactly what this was. Even the wrestler's court, I always felt like it was in jest. I never felt like it was a serious, you know, these guys think that I was disrespecting Eddie Guerrero, because Eddie never took it that way. You know, Eddie and I had spoken about it and we had hugged, and Eddie was fantastic about it. And I remember, you know, I think it was Sean Sapp who wrote that article a couple of years ago and said that the story wasn't, and to be honest, I'm not just saying it, I never really paid attention much to it after that, but said that, you know, Eddie exploded and went nuts. Absolutely not. He was fantastic. I just kept saying, I'm sorry, I don't, you know, and he was awesome. And he never once lost his temper, never exploded. He talked to me. We sat down, we talked about the business and his father, and ultimately he gave me a hug. And that was the end of it for me and Eddie. It was everybody else who, you know, to be honest, might have just been bored on another trip to Japan that kind of took it and ran with it. And even then, I never took it that seriously. And I don't mean that in a disrespectful way. I just don't think that the guys like The Undertaker and Triple H and Shawn, you know, ever really thought that I went up to Eddie and like slapped him in the face like that. I think they knew. And I remember Big Show even made a comment in the locker room the next night to Kurt. He said something like, hey, Kurt, haven't you gotten him in enough trouble? You know, leave him alone. Because I think to talk to me about it after. So I think everybody kind of knew that I was, you know, set up, so to speak. But again, I don't think Kurt meant any harm. But yeah, that is a story that just kind of took off and went to 10 in a matter of a night.
Well, it's got the best punchline ever. Kurt Angle comes up to you and says, maybe he shouldn't use that. And he doesn't know. You go up to Eddie and say something, and Eddie's dad invented the move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How much of an asshole am I for feeding into that? And also, I should have known better, because I bet half the guys in the locker room, even the new guys, knew that Eddie's father invented the move. It's my move. And I don't even know who invented it. And again, that just tells you my inexperience at the time. You know, I mean, like I said, I was 24. I'm 38 now. I'll be 38 next month. So I look back on that and I see a kid who definitely needed some guidance, who did not know what he was doing or what he was getting into.
Where was Daivari on that one? He should have smartened you up, man.
Oh, he probably tried. I don't think Sean was a part of that. I know, you know, he's got his story about what happened afterwards when they're at the bar and they're making me buy the drinks. And, you know, I wish I could say this now, but at the time, a $2,000 bar tab really didn't hurt me too much. And I honestly felt like I needed some redemption. I'm not kidding. I felt horrible. I mean, that's Eddie's father. And here I am disrespecting a legend like Eddie Guerrero. You know, there was definitely, you know, some restitution that needed to be paid. Whether $2,000 was, you know, a fair amount is, I guess, questionable, but I felt like I needed, you know, redemption from that, because I did feel like a gigantic ass for doing that.
We kind of got off the rails here on a couple subjects, but I want to get back to the timeline of your career, because you made your debut, you started a winning streak beating guys like Benoit and Jericho. And
real quick, I just wanted to ask, how was it working with Benoit?
it was awesome. You know, Chris was in OVW for a while, and I remember when he was in OVW rehabbing his neck, I had asked him to watch my matches, and he did. I mean, Chris was a guy who, you know, lived wrestling, and he would watch my matches and he would critique me. And so to get to work with Chris in the ring was an honor for me. And I had some really good matches, and as vicious as he was in the ring, he was very gentle as well. And he would talk you through and he would tell you what to do. And Chris was a babyface, and typically heels would lead the match, but I was an inexperienced heel. So usually if I'm working with Benoit, Jericho, Shawn Michaels, they're more or less leading the match. And Chris was, he was great to work with. He really was. He obviously was a tremendous wrestler, but he was also a brilliant strategist in the ring, and we had some very good matches. And he was stiffish, just stiff as hell, man. I remember I could still feel Chris Benoit's chops. Right. My chest is still red in one spot from a few of them, I'm sure.
You wrestled some legends. You started a winning streak, beating guys like Benoit and Jericho. And there was hate and blowback immediately. Daivari would get death threats on his blog. There was a negative mention of you guys in Newsweek. And WWE received criticism by all kinds of media, including the United Arab Emirates newspaper, which said that World Wrestling Entertaining is exploiting a negative stereotype of Arabs, which is perpetrated through news and entertainment media alike to make money. Was this kind of attention good for you professionally? Was it something that WWE wanted to see? Was this kind of feedback, or has it started to get negative yet for you?
I think it's something they initially wanted to see, but I think they wanted to see it in a more cartoonish fashion when it started to become very real. That was, you know, obviously when talk of the character being pulled started to happen. And it really wasn't pushback from, I mean, back from sponsors at the time after the Undertaker thing, but a lot of what drove that character off the air was a lot of pushback from Arab groups who were saying exactly that. We were poor, you really can't dispute it. We were portraying Arabs in a negative light, and we were kind of unfairly stereotyping them as being radical and extremist.
So the Royal Rumble comes, and you were heel at the time, obviously, and you get eliminated by heels and faces.
Yeah, they wanted to just demonstrate that everybody hated Muhammad Hassan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whether it was a heel or a babyface, they hated us. And so, yeah, that was definitely planned. And it was really cool, actually, for me. I don't think that happens too often, where you're eliminated from the Royal Rumble by both heels and babyfaces collaboratively. I got my ass kicked collaboratively by both. So it was pretty cool.
And do you think the message that was told to the audience was that you were the worst of the worst?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was tremendous heat. I mean, there was no home for me. There was no stable for Muhammad Hassan. I was definitely an outcast.
True, but what it did was led to some great things for you. And one of those things was your WrestleMania moment. It started when Eugene came out having a good time. And of course, here comes Hassan and Daivari to beat him down. And then Hulk Hogan made the save. How big of a highlight was that for you? What do you remember about that night?
Oh, that was huge on many different levels, because Eugene is Nick Dinsmore. Nick Dinsmore is by far one of the more influential people in my career. Nick was my trainer from the get-go. From the first time I walked into Saturday class at OVW as a 21-year-old, pretty scrawny kid from Syracuse, Nick was a huge influence. He was my trainer. So to be out there with Nick, and remember, I lost the belt to him at OVW while in that three-way matchup. Like I said, I think Jeter won. It's funny how you don't remember those things. Huge to be out there with Nick. That was definitely an honor. And then to have Hulk Hogan come out was absolutely amazing. It is definitely one of the more prominent moments in my career for, like I said, for a few different reasons. So it was just amazing.
Do you remember finding out that that was going to happen and what your reaction was going to be?
Yeah, no, I remember my reaction being like, holy shit, this is awesome. And again, it was even more awesome because I was out there with Nick, who, you know, like I said, it just a big influence on my career. But yeah, no, of course, when we found out, we were like, you know, giddy, you know, to say the least.
When Hogan was with us for a few years at TNA Impact Wrestling, I got to do a few backstage things with him, and I thought, like, that was the coolest thing. I can't even imagine knowing that you're going into WrestleMania doing it with him. Like, this is unreal, man.
Yeah, no, I got to have a few good moments with Hogan. I mean, and he was always great to me. He was always very welcoming, very friendly. You know, I worked with him on a few different occasions, that match in Boston as well. So, yeah, it was just – and, you know, I grew up in the Hogan era. I still remember WrestleMania 3, Hogan versus Andre the Giant in the Pontiac Silverdome, watching him slam him, watching him at my friend's house. I think I was 8 years old. So, yeah, to be able to actually wrestle him – I mean, my father still has the picture of me shaking his hand in his office. You know, it was something that was a huge moment for all of us.
In a very short time, you went from Lawler to Hogan, and then you went to Hogan and HBK in a tag match, and then you started getting some world title shots. You got one against Batista, and you got one against Cena. There had to be no doubt in your mind where everything was headed at this point.
Absolutely. You know, one thing we learned in OVW, and not to take any away from Batista or Cena, is if you're over, you don't need a belt. So I never knew and I never really thought I was going to win the heavyweight title. It would have been definitely a notch in my belt. But, you know, we knew the character was big. And Batista and Cena were two guys that, you know, I came up with in OVW. And they're obviously much further ahead than I was. But, you know, we had an idea that this character was huge and that we were definitely moving up the card, so to speak.
For sure. On June 23rd, you were drafted to SmackDown. When were you told about this? How did you feel about it? And what did you feel it did to your push?
Well, to be honest, I remember being told about it and being very unhappy about it. Like I said, everything in Japan was behind me. The SmackDown locker room at the time was very different than the Raw locker room. And so I had, you know, I had friends in the Raw locker room. And, you know, I had the top card guys, I mean, Hunter and Sean and Chris, you know, Jericho and, you know, even like Val Venus. And, you know, I'm thinking of these guys who after Japan, which was one of the lower points in my life, because obviously, like I had, you know, previously stated, I felt like a giant ass. It started to turn around and I finally felt like I was fitting in and, you know, I was welcomed by the guys and Christian. And, you know, I'm just thinking of all the guys who were there and Kane. And then suddenly I moved over to SmackDown and I remember being very depressed about it because I didn't know those guys and those guys over there, you know, we had traveled together for those, you know, international trips. And those were some of the more harsher people in the WWE at the time. I was not happy. And I remember and not only that, but I was smart enough to know that Raw was on network television, which had different censorship standards than, you know, than cable did. And SmackDown was on CW, which was cable at the time. And so I knew that the Hassan character was edgy and I knew we weren't going to be able to get away with what we had gotten away with on Raw. And I remember vocalizing that opinion to Stephanie McMahon. And again, that was one of the times where I should have kept my mouth shut, but I spoke and they weren't happy with that. They felt that I was ungrateful and I don't think I approached it in an ungrateful manner, but I definitely wasn't gung-ho about it. And I definitely knew we were going to be handcuffed a little bit with the Hassan character and we were going to run into some trouble. I don't want to say I foresaw everything that was going to happen, but you know, in a way I did because that was why I was upset. And I felt comfortable enough with Stephanie at the time because she was the one who I would speak with mainly. She was one of the head writers who would tell me what I was going out and talking about that night. Like I said, I wasn't really scripted. A lot of what Sean and I did was unscripted and Stephanie would just kind of feed us what we needed to hit and we would hit it. And I told her I wasn't happy. I didn't think that it was a good move. And I was criticized for that. And, you know, ultimately it turned out that my feelings and my intuition was right.
How was it working with Stone Cold Steve Austin?
Oh, it was good. It was fine. It was actually really cool working with Stone Cold. He was cool. You know, I would have loved to have wrestled him to say that I wrestled Stone Cold, but I'm happy, you know, I'm happy saying that we worked a segment together with Shelton Benjamin. I wish I would have kept that belt a little longer. I don't know if I'm in the history books as holding the Intercontinental title because he reversed it so quickly, but no, it was cool. He was definitely easy to work with.
Well, is there anyone that you didn't work with, like any big star that you didn't work with in some way while you were there? You pretty much hit everybody, right?
The Rock. I didn't work with The Rock.
But was he full-time at the time? No, he wasn't,
no,
right?
No, he wasn't. And you know what? The Rock, I met him in Buffalo when I was in college, right before I moved to Louisville, and he was just unbelievably cool. I mean, it's The Rock, and here I am, this college student in Buffalo. He's at Gold's Gym, and that's where I worked out. And I went up and I talked to him, and he was complimentary of me, and he was very approachable, and he was very talkative, and he was just awesome. And I remember thinking, man, this is The Rock. You know, if this guy is this cool, you know, maybe everybody's this cool. You know, I'm definitely doing this. And then, you know, I didn't get to work with him, but his father, Rocky Johnson, was a trainer in OVW, and he helped me work on my punches. And The Rock actually used to pass messages to Trish Stratus, because, and to me, telling me not to waste my punches. And I thought that was, and I almost wanted to say, and I don't know if he knew or not, like, hey, you know, your dad taught me how to throw this punch. Cause he would say, cause I remember she came up to me and she said, hey, I was talking to Rocky, and he wanted me to tell you, don't waste that punch. You throw such a good punch. Make sure it counts. Don't just keep throwing them. Make sure that they're sold. And I say, you know, the irony is your dad taught me how to throw that punch.
That's awesome.
But yeah, you know, he's the only guy that I could think of that I didn't get to work with. I mean, I was blessed for sure.
Well, let's definitely get to it. You know, within 2 weeks of you getting a SmackDown, you are injected right away in the title picture into a six-man match. And then come SmackDown tape July 4th to air on July 7th, what everybody remembers, and I'm going to read from PW Torch, Wade Keller. He said, The Undertaker beat Daivari at 1 minute and 34 seconds with a tombstone piledriver. After the match, Hassan called down four masked men in combat gear to attack The Undertaker. After leaving Undertaker lifeless in the ring, the four men elevated Daivari in the air and carried him off as if he was a martyr for sacrificing his body for Hassan's higher purpose. Taz and Cole talked about how they had never seen anything like that in all their years in watching wrestling. They're not alone. What were you told to do? Who told you to do it? And how was it presented to you?
We knew we were setting up a match between myself and The Undertaker. We had an idea that that match I was going to win, and I was definitely not going to win it clean, to go on to take on Batista at SummerSlam in DC, where I actually was living at the time, and so was Batista, and I was going to win. And that was kind of like the Arab's big FU to the world, is winning the heavyweight title in the capital of the United States. I don't remember who was the agent for that match. It was probably one of the top agents, probably Arn or Dean. And we were told to do exactly what we did. And the irony is all of those men in ski masks were white. That was really the first time we used them. And, you know, we wanted to make it dramatic, and we wanted to create this heat. I mean, The Undertaker is the biggest legend in WWE history. I don't think that's really arguable as far as longevity of a career and, you know, the accolades go. But, we did what we were told to do, which was go out there, and what every bad guy or top heel does, and use a bunch of other guys to beat the crap out of the top babyface. So, I mean, we executed it the way we were told to execute it. It went well. I mean, obviously, as you guys are about to bring up, the trouble is what happened in history, you know, on the day that it went to from tape to live on a Thursday, which was the London bombing in 2005.
That is exactly what happened. A bombing in London at the time, unfortunately, it's a lot more common now than it was then. It was a huge story. The thing about that is, Mark, is that even though the angle was shot, they had the choice to run it. And they decided to run the angle that night. Was there talk of editing the angle out in the wake of the bombings?
Not with me, no. To be honest, it didn't really hit me at the time that this was insensitive to what was going on in London. I know they aired it in London with a crawler at the bottom, you know, almost like a warning. But there was no talk with me about pulling that segment. And I think it was too important to the angle at the time.
So you don't think it was a mistake to leave it in?
Well, in hindsight, yeah, I guess it turned out to be a pretty big mistake. But at the time, I don't remember having any feelings that we should pull it. No.
Well, the angle didn't get reported on immediately in mainstream media because there were too many other details of the bombing. But by the time the following week came around, it had become the talk of all wrestling media. WWE spokesman Gary Davis told Variety, people will see what happens this week, he said, as the storyline gets straightened out. Mark, it seems at first that WWE was willing to bet on an all publicity is good publicity kind of strategy, and they were going to try to use it to their advantage, but there was a tipping point and changes happened. When did you find out, and who told you that everything was about to change?
You know what? It had to have been a week or two later. I mean, yeah, like you said, it took a little while for this to really sink in. I remember Johnny Ace, who was the director of talent relations at the time, told us that the characters were being pulled, and we didn't really know where it was going to go. I know initially we had planned on fighting it, and we were talking about doing some talk show appearances and trying to maybe soften the character, make Muhammad Hassan and Khosrow Dabari a little more human. But ultimately, I remember, at the time, I was looking to buy a house, and I remember asking Johnny Ace and, you know, telling him and being very honest, like, is this something that I should do? And he was like, you know what? No, you probably shouldn't. And that was when I knew. That was when I knew that the character was going to pull it off TV.
Wow. Holy shit. That has got to be a feeling in your stomach like no other.
Yeah, it definitely was. And when he said that, I still didn't know that it was gonna be the end of the character, but we were told that that character was no longer welcome on CW on cable television or network television, and we knew we had that pay-per-view match, but it really wasn't until a week or two before we were booking that match that we knew that was going to be my last match in the WWE.
After the appearance where they had Daivari carried off and they had the Men in Black masks, they took you off TV, but they still had you wrestle at the Great American Bash. The Undertaker gave you a powerbomb onto the concrete, and the camera eventually focused on the area below the stage to show you splattered on the concrete, and a pool of blood showed up next to your body as paramedics and agents strapped you to a stretcher and wheeled you to an ambulance. Your characters were essentially killed off after this match, and this was you, Mark Capenny's last professional wrestling match. Is that correct?
Ever. Yep, and I've never been back in the ring since.
What's your reason that you never wanted to get back in the ring?
I don't think I saw longevity in it. I mean, I can think of a couple of guys, I can count them on one hand that I knew coming up. Chris Masters, Nick Aldis, you know, some guys that have been very successful on the independents. I know a lot more who have not been. And so when I was done with wrestling, I kind of made a very conscious decision to be done with wrestling.
Yeah.
And you know, I thought about doing independence. I got offers and, you know, I considered it. But at that point, I was ready to move on. You know, OVW is probably a bright spot in my wrestling career, even though that's supposed to be the you know, training program and, you know, kind of like the farm team of the WWE. But when you get to the WWE, it's much different. And it was a much different experience for me. So when wrestling was over for me, I knew I needed to move on, and I made that decision, and I didn't want to entice myself by going back. I didn't want to end up, you know, one of those guys who didn't realize that their prime was over, that there's the spotlight was gone, and that we're still trying to grab it and catch it for the next 20 years. So when wrestling was over, it was over. And you know what? Going out against The Undertaker in Buffalo, which is where I decided to be a wrestler in the first place, because that's, remember I said I went to college there, and that's when I decided I was moving to Louisville. You know, I'm very into the dramatics. And so I kind of felt like that was it. And then that was the end of me as a wrestler, and I stuck true to that.
Well, you sound 1,000% confident in your decision and that you're at peace with it.
Absolutely.
How much of it at the time, because as I did all the research on your story, it made me sad. And to me, I'm just wondering, it sounds like someone who fell in love and found true love and tried love and got his heart broken and said, forget this, I'm out. Was that an element of it for you?
That was part of it. And maybe I outgrew that love. You know, it takes a very special person to be in wrestling and to be successful for that long. I can think of John Cena and Randy Orton and Brock, really. I mean, maybe there's the couple I'm missing, but I'm thinking of the guys I came up with. I mean, Batista has clearly moved on and become wildly successful, and I'm very happy for him. Same with John. I mean, you know, same with all of them. But it takes a very special person to stay in this business for 20 years and to have success. And, you know, it was not for me. And that's, it's as simple as that. You know, ultimately, I still loved what I did. I'm proud of what I did. And I grew from what I did as a wrestler, and I would never trade any of my experiences and even the negative ones for the world, because that made me who I am today. But in the end, it wasn't for me, and I needed to find a new career and a new meaning for my life.
Do you still watch at all? Do you keep track of what's going on in wrestling these days?
I really don't. Not because I dislike wrestling, but I don't have time. I really don't. And people approach me all the time and they say, did you see this? And I have, I work in a high school, so I have kids all the time who wrestling fans come up to me and, hey, so-and-so won the belt. Did you watch WrestleMania? Did you watch this? And I have it, you know, and so I really don't follow it anymore. I kind of outgrew it.
Well, Robbie, I do not know how we're going to top this one. And as we do at our shows, we've heard the story, and I'd like to ask Robbie to tell me and Mark and our audience, in his opinion, why it ended.
I think there really is no real answer for why it ended. I mean, I think it was 1,000% out of Mark's hands, and it just ended because it was time to end. The character was done, you know?
Mark, let me ask you this as we come to a close and find out what you're up to now. What are the lessons that you pass along to others from your Muhammad Hassan experience?
Definitely appreciating what you have in the moment. Definitely being humble. I think at 24, I had a little bit of arrogance to me as a young man. And I find that to be pointless today at 38. No matter how good you are, no matter how talented you are, there's always somebody that works harder than you. There's always somebody more talented than you. You have to find what's inside of you that makes you unique, and you have to make that work for you. A lot of it is being a respectful and honest human being and doing not what's easy, but what's right. A lot of what I learned and a lot of what I experienced growing up, because I was really growing up in my early 20s in the WWE, has kind of fueled what I've become at 38. And so working with kids and having the honor of working with a lot of these kids who come from underprivileged homes. I work in a district that is, low socioeconomic status, a disadvantaged district. I was told no. And I was laughed at, and I'll never forget, one of my closest friends told me, she literally said, everybody back home is laughing at you. And I brought my first wrestling match home, and all my friends laughed at how awful I was. And so a lot of what I learned is perseverance and working hard and not giving up on yourself, because the second you give up on yourself, everybody else is going to give up on you too. A good medium for me to be, and kids trust me and they believe me because they know that I've had that element of success. But I'm comfortable with it completely. And at this point at 38, like I said, I own what happened. And you'll never hear me say I was bullied or I was victimized or I regret anything. I don't. And I wasn't, never a victim. I am very proud of everything that I did.
We totally appreciate your time and giving us all this time for this interview. And I think everyone is going to be pleased and, super entertained listening to your story.
No, thank you. And you know what? I do want to say that, in the last few months, I have been doing more appearances. I'm going to be appearing at the Heroes Hideout in Rensselaer, which is right outside Albany, on April 14th for a question and answer. I'm setting something up with IWF in Rochester. Like I said, now that I am very busy, but now that I have a little bit more free time, I'm definitely looking to do some appearances, some signings, question and answers. I'm definitely available. So, like I said, I'm proud of everything I've done. And now that it's in the past and, I'm much more settled with everything, I'm definitely getting out there a little bit more.
That's funny that you say that, Dave, because I am actually at Heroes Hideout. How could people reach out to you if they do want to book you for appearances?
They can reach out to me, message me on Facebook. They could definitely email me. M. Capani, C-O-P-A-N-I, at Oswego, OSWEGO.edu. Also, I'm on Twitter. My handle is at M. Capani, C-O-P-A-N-I-1.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm excited for April because I'm hoping that Robbie challenges the 38-year-old former Muhammad Hassan to a match in the ring.
He ain't going to go from The Undertaker to Robbie, man. That'll just be a career kill.
That's actually worse than going from The Undertaker to off television, I think.
Screw you.
Hey, thanks a lot for joining us, Mark. We really appreciate it.
Hey, no problem. Thank you guys for having me.
Thanks, man.
Robbie, I don't know how we're going to top that interview. We are off to an awesome start. What do you think about the voyage of Mohammed Hassan?
Hey, this is I think now the second week in a row, and I think this is going to be an ongoing thing for us, where the guys that we have on, just not what you would expect. Like, I don't know why or what, and I feel like the people are going to react the same. I just was not expecting him to be the way that he was. Were you?
Not at all. We got a comment on Twitter that nobody expected Glacier to sound like he was from the South. I certainly didn't expect Mohammed Hassan to be the most evolved, chillest dude ever.
He had a great career, and I'm glad that he's happy with how it ended and he's happy in his life now. But it is really, you know, your WWE career, just one day, they're just telling you it's over. Like, just think about that.
And check it out. December 2004, the debut. July 2005, it's over.
Okay, so how many... Give me that, because I'm not that good at math. How long is this? Wait, December to July to January, February, March, April, May, June, July. It could be 7 months-ish.
Seven months. That's insane.
Right. Oh, my God. 7 months. But in those 7 months, just look at the names we talked about. Lawler, Sergeant Slaughter, Batista, John Cena, Hogan. Randy Orton, Hogan, Stone Cold Steve Austin. Like, did he ever even wrestle anyone that was not like a main event guy? Jericho, Benoit.
What do you think about him just walking away? I think there's definitely an element to him having his heart broken. What do you think?
You know what it is? The character being taken away from WWE, it's like, what was he going to do? Go do that character in the indies? You know what I mean? After he just wrestled all these big stars, now he's going to bring it to the independent scene and do it. You know, it's ballsy, but I got to give him props and say, what a way to go out. You know, starting with The Undertaker, ending with The Undertaker. It is pretty cool when you think about it. And it shows, I mean, it's ballsy, man, just to say, hey, I'm done with this. I'm going to end it this way.
And it's the kind of story you won't hear anywhere else. If you want to reach us on Why It Ended, you can reach us out on Twitter. It's at Why It Ended, or you can go to whyitended.com. And we've also got our Instagram page almost updated and going. Robbie, how can people get a hold of you? I think people need to know this, is that Robbie E is not like a lot of other podcast hosts. He is in the prime of his wrestling career. So y'all better book this man, because it's about to get busy. How do you get a hold of Robbie E to book him for one of your shows?
Well, RobbieEbookings@gmail.com. And then, of course, Instagram is at RealRobbieE. Twitter is at RobbieEImpact. And yeah, that's it. I mean, bro, today's not even about me. It's about him. That was, I am blown away still by that interview, man. That was awesome.
And we're going to keep trying to bring you those kind of interviews. We're going to keep bringing you things you haven't heard before. And we're going to make sure you always want to ask why it ended. It's a beautiful day.
Stops.